water.
We're ready when you are, sir.
Your Honor, may it please the court.
My name is Jay Martellino. I'm here for Desmond Rio, and we're here. You all are familiar with this. If I may just address something that the Attorney General had placed about the petition for appeal and the assignment of error and the change.
Certainly, but let me interrupt you. Do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes.
All right, very well.
Will that be okay, sir?
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you.
With regards to the changing the grant of the petition for appeal to the appellate brief, I did put a few extra words, but it's, Your Honor, the grant of the petition for appeal didn't have what exactly was granted, and I added that language, but that was the whole argument. So if I made any error, please blame that on me, not on my client. But
I understand. If I recall correctly, I think that much of the opening brief, in fact, was cut and pasted.
It was, Your Honor.
So
but the
nothing. It was not anything new, but there was a change.
It was a change in the petition. The
assignment of error.
Assignment of error, but that assignment of error, it still was the whole argument in the petition for appeal addressed that assignment of error, and my whole appellant brief addressed that one assignment of error. It's a single issue, really, that we are here on appeal for. So if I made a mistake, I made a mistake, but and I'm sorry. It's just that I was just trying to clarify my whole petition for appeal in my appellate brief. So I would like to just start off with, yes, a lot of people have made errors in this case. I mean, Desmond Rio, obviously, he's fouled up. He's guilty of something. But everybody who touched this dang case has made an error that I can see. The initial appointed attorney didn't notice that charges were duplicative from preliminary hearing to certification, and then the prosecution eventually null prost one of the charges as duplicative because the initial attorney didn't notice that. The prosecution changed a charge or one of the charges was 18.2308.4 B or C or A or whatever, but didn't have any subsection in the warrant stage, and then changed the language from the warrant to the indictment. And there's no formal notice of that change that changes it from the one that has no mandatory minimum punishment to the one that has a 2-year mandatory minimum punishment. The initial appointed counsel was relieved when Mr. Rio hired another counsel who got, yes, it was a good deal, but there is nothing on the record showing that she or Judge McCallum had warned Mr. Rio that there was a 2-year mandatory minimum if he had violated the terms of his probation, of the conditions. Nobody in there, it's not on any paper, it's not said on the record, nowhere is that. Nowhere is it that they're on the record. So,
and as a result, the issue was never raised at the trial level.
Issue was never raised at the trial level, at least until it was too late when I got in, and then perhaps I should have filed a motion to withdraw or vacate the plea. But I'm trying to get the judge to see that, look, judge, there is an error here, and he's violated the conditions of his plea, but here, give him a chance. I have told him here that he's fouled up, and he's been incarcerated, and the judge could have said, okay, I see that there's this, but here, really, you should take advantage of this, try again.
But if we step in and fix it, you're inviting us to participate in the screw-ups so that they have a...
No, I'm asking you to fix the screw-ups, because, Your Honor, as I'm saying, and I don't think that there's a listed case, at least in Virginia, that I found, that there is some new precedents coming out of the federal courts that judges have a duty to make sure that counsel follow the Constitution, that everybody follows the Constitution, but to warn people of the dangers of what they're facing. I made an attempt...
That creates an additional problem, doesn't it? If we start imposing a new duty on the trial court, that they need to, in effect, represent the interests of the defendant?
No, they're not necessarily representing the interests of the defendant. They're representing the interests of the whole judicial system. That's why I called it structural error, because that's what it is. It's the judges in that colloquy in the Rule 3A, the Form 6, the guilty plea form. It asks 24 questions so far. Most of the courts have added a few questions here, like, do you understand English? Or do you recognize that there may be immigration consequences?
The deportation.
Yes. And a lot of courts have started adding those, but those are 24 questions. Among those questions is that... do you understand that there may be a mandatory minimum punishment, or inform the people of that? And there's nowhere showing. In fact, in the warrant stage, there was no mandatory minimum punishment. It wasn't until indictment stage that there was a mandatory minimum punishment. And even then, I forget whether it was the VCC code section that was wrong, or the code section that didn't have the subparagraph that changed from the mandatory minimum punishment charge to the two-year mandatory minimum punishment charge. At no point was he, Mr. Rio, advised whether it was should have been done by his prior counsel, either of the first two prior counsels. I'm unfortunately the third counsel, or whether the prosecution should have said it in open court if the prosecutor had realized it, or the judge, really, is whom I'm saying had a duty to say, look, here it is. You know, you recognize that there's a two-year mandatory. Not you're at a crossroads. Obviously, it's a crossroads. Anytime one goes to court, really, they should be at some kind of crossroads, whether it is a major intersection or just a change of direction, whether you should be going slower or faster, speeding, or whether you should decide whether you should have guns, which he had legally. And this was a prescription drug. But notwithstanding that, whether he should make a decision to clean his act up and decide to follow rules, which, I mean, he probably did not. But the question is whether he understood the ramifications.
Counsel, what would be the consequence if we were to reverse this? It would be reversed and remanded. What would be the consequences to your client?
He's incarcerated right now, Your Honor.
That.
But I think that if you reversed it and remanded it on, like, is a...
Well, you don't suggest reverse and dismiss.
No, I'm just asking that it be remanded. It could be tried as the felon in possession, but the one that does not carry the two-year mandatory minimum, or give him the opportunity to withdraw his plea if he so chooses and decide, given that he knows now that there's a two-year mandatory minimum but did not know at the time he entered the agreement. So I don't suggest that it be reversed and dismissed, no.
So what are you asking? I guess my question is, what are you asking the court to do if we were to reverse it and remand it?
Realistically, I'd just be asking the court to consider that he's been incarcerated since his rearrest date and give him long-term time served is what I'd be asking for on the regular 18.23084.
But you'd ask the trial court.
I'd be asking the trial court once you remand it. But he's a felon. I think that's going to be clear. But whether he deserves a two-year mandatory minimum for somebody who'd never been incarcerated before this all happened, that's what I'm asking. It's because he did not understand. He would continue to maintain to you, if he were here, that he didn't understand. Somebody should have warned him, and it's nowhere. In fact, the judge or his second attorney, told him, incorrectly, which is in the guilty plea form, that there is no mandatory minimum, which is wrong. So he was not just not warned, he was affirmatively told wrong information. And I'm asking you to fix that. Help me fix that. Help us fix it.
Very well. Thank you, sir. Ms. Johnson.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Victoria Johnson for the Commonwealth. It's almost a truism at this point that no one is guaranteed a perfect trial or criminal proceeding, only a fair one. Here, Mr. Rio got a fair shake. He had an excellent plea agreement that he had every opportunity to abide with. Counsel's assignment of error alleges that the trial court erred when sentencing. It alleges sentencing error, that the trial court abused its discretion when it sentenced Mr. Rio to the mandatory minimum sentence for his gun charge. A court doesn't abuse its discretion when it follows the law and you know, imposes a statutorily required minimum sentence. As to Mr. Rio's position that he was not advised of his two-year mandatory minimum, that's really a due process concern, not a sentencing concern, and that argument isn't exactly comprehended within the assignment of error and was never really raised below. Mr. Rio went at the violation hearing and testified that he had not been told about the two-year mandatory minimum. The trial court apparently rejected that testimony. Due process does not require that a not guilty plea, because the plea to the drug charge was a not guilty plea. He just stipulated to the facts. He only pleaded guilty to the drug charge. So 3A8 doesn't really apply. The colloquy doesn't apply. The United States Supreme Court, and I didn't include this in my brief because this is a due process decision from the United States Supreme Court, and this was a sentencing error case. But in 1914 in Garland versus United States, I can give the court the citation. It's 232 U.S. 642. In 1914, the Supreme Court of the United States held that there's no particular form of procedure in a not guilty plea arraignment. That's in sharp contrast to the guilty plea situation that we're all familiar with. This court in Simmons v. Commonwealth, and that's 54 VA App 594, relied on Garland to hold that the failure to arraign on a not guilty plea for attempted murder was harmless error when there's no prejudice. So that's not, this isn't structural error.
Counsel, did he ever plead at all to the firearms charge?
Your
and
Honor,
if so, where?
It's not in the joint appendix, but on July 15th, 2014, if the court looks in the record, there is a, he was brought in to schedule trial. Trial was set that day. He would have had to have entered a not guilty plea at that point, both charges for a trial to be set. He would have been arraigned then at that initial appearance.
So we just need to.
So you think there's an inference there?
Yes, there's the presumption of regularity. He would have been arraigned at that point and entered a not guilty plea in order to set the trial. And I was relying, if the court's indulgence, I relied on the court's official website. For Colonial Heights, it's on the court's webpage. There's an entry on July 15th, 2013, at 9:30 a.m., set for trial. And that's in case number F01-66203.
Set for trial. It doesn't say anything about what the plea was.
No, Your Honor,
but presume that in
the presumption of regularity, he would have had to have entered a not guilty plea or it wouldn't have been set. Kind of moving forward from that, even if under the Simmons case that I cited to the court just now, even if he had not been arraigned, it would only be reversible error if he could show that he was not able to defend himself. Here he had the indictment. The indictment had the aggravating language in it, the owner about your person, that takes it to the two-year mandatory minimum sentence. This court has held over and over again, most recently I think in Paduano v. Commonwealth, that as long as the indictment tracks the statutory language and gives fair notice of what the charge is, that is plenty of notice to the defendant. That's not a problem with the indictment. And you know, kind of moving along, The plea waiver form does bear both case numbers at the top of it in the appendix. However, the plea colloquy at appendix 11 to 14 makes clear that the court is only accepting a guilty plea on the drug charge. The court says over and over again, we're going to hear the plea on the single charge, on the drug charge. So the defendant was given his process rights. I can't imagine that a defendant, you know, is very familiar with VCC numbers. I don't think that would help or hinder him in any way. As I said, the indictment bore the aggravating language, which would have put him and his attorney on notice. There was a strong interest for the defendant in entering this plea agreement. Had he abided by the terms of the plea agreement, both charges went away because he was a first-time offender at that point.
Well, counsel, just because something's a good deal doesn't mean, I mean, if there's a problem with it, there's a problem with it. Can you respond to the argument about the subsection being missing and there's no indication of what subsection?
At the warrant? I believe the argument is that on the warrant there was a missing, that the subsection wasn't listed. I believe that the indictment supplants the warrant once the indictment is issued.
The subsection was in the indictment?
The indictment, Your Honor, I will get to that page number, is page 6 of the joint appendix. It doesn't have the subsection, but it has the language from the subsection on or about his person, a firearm, and that's the aggravating language. That's the, if you just have a gun with drugs, then you only have, I believe, a 1-year sentence. But if it's on or about your person, that ups it to the 2 years.
So you're saying the language cures the defect by not having the subsection in there?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's consistent with this court's case law. If the indictment tracks the language of the statute, the indictment provides sufficient notice to the accused. What's important in a not guilty plea and in an indictment is that the defendant have reasonable notice so that he can decide how to defend himself against the charge. Here, the indictment plainly states, and the indictment was on July 15th, 2013, was returned July 15th, 2013. It plainly states that he unlawfully and feloniously had in his possession or on and about his person a firearm while simultaneously being in possession of Schedule 1 or 2 controlled substance. And if the defendant had, you know, chose to present a defense, that he had every opportunity to do so. Instead, he and his attorney made this decision to enter into this plea agreement. To the extent that there's an allegation that the defense counsel did not inform him and, you know, was essentially performed efficiently, that's proper for a habeas petition. That's not really something that we have a factual record on. You know, in a habeas petition, we could talk to the attorney and find out what exactly did or did not happen. And I think on this record...
Don't we have a 5A18 issue anyway?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. Thank you. There is a 5A18 issue. This wasn't really raised in the trial court. The defendant did get up and say that he didn't know about the 2-year mandatory minimum, but he never asked to withdraw his guilty plea or be released from his plea agreement in any way. What the defendant sought to do was have another shot at his deferred disposition contract, and the trial court did not allow that, and that was certainly reasonable within the terms of the plea agreement, and the court very sternly and very seriously warned the defendant that there's no second chances with this type of plea agreement. This is kind of almost extraordinary relief. He doesn't give defendants second chances. Furthermore, at the violation hearing, the defendant, you know, claimed to have prescription drugs in his possession. That's why he was violated, but he never provided the prescription. And I think that the trial court, you know, maybe had some credibility issues with the defendant because of that, and because of his sort of self-serving claim that no one ever told him about the 2-year. He also claimed at the violation hearing that had he known about the 2-year mandatory minimum, he would have complied with the agreement. However, you know, in the guilty plea, he faced a 10-year maximum on the drug charge, and that didn't motivate him along either. For all of those reasons, there's just no abuse of discretion here. There was no due process problem here. The defendant had a fair criminal proceeding. below, and we would ask that you affirm. If the court has other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
No questions, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal, Mr. Martellino?
Your Honor.
Just with regards to whether he had a chance at an arraignment, the procedure in the local courts in Central Virginia is that July 15, 2013, that was docket call. Look at the page, top of page 6 or top of page 3 or so. That's docket call. That's just the day when cases are set. Nobody's, for purposes of the presumption of regularity, nobody comes in and pleads guilty, not guilty. They just set this case for trial, and then the first trial date is the time when the arraignment should have happened. So I disagree with Ms. Johnson about a presumption of regularity or her idea of the regularity versus the regularity that actually happens in Chesterfield or Richmond or Henrico. Your Honor, I think it's just a question of, do you determine whether this is structural error, whether I fouled up, whether the prior counsel fouled up, prior counsel before fouled up. Your Honor, everybody's fouled up. But I say that the judge fouled up, too.
You just don't want us to foul up.
You're here to fix things, please. Thank you.